I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The last night of Hanukkah is tomorrow night. Christmas is less than a week away, and New Year's Eve is close on the horizon, so it's time to be sure that the halls are decked and plans for holiday meals are well underway. Whether it's your grandmother's potato latkes, a turkey, a goose, or a feast of seven fishes, no culinary compendium is complete without an enticing selection of both wines and spirits. Al Spohler and Hugh Sisson have hosted WIPR's Cellar Notes for 25 years. They are our sommeliers this afternoon as we discuss the best wines to pair with all of your festive repasts. And for suggestions for spirits, we turn to craft bartender and food photographer Chino Chin of Pinch in the Mount Vernon Marketplace. Midday on Wines and Spirits, that's coming up right after the news. And good afternoon. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're joining us. So, plethoric cleaning, awkward sleeping arrangements, brokering peace between feuding relatives. Oh, and those three-hour lines at TSA. Ah, the holidays. But perhaps there's one simple question that may universally ease stress and put the light back in the eyes of you and your guests. May I offer you a drink? But once that question is proffered, then what? As we skid full steam ahead into Christmas and New Year's, many of us will have to confront the tricky task of choosing the right wines for our holiday celebrations. The aisles in the wine stores are seemingly endless. How do we decide between Rioja or Priorat, Pinot Gris or Pinot Grigio? And what exactly does one pair with green bean casserole? Always wondered that. Well, we've got you covered today. We're talking wines and spirits to share, or not to share, depending on how you're getting along, with friends and family this holiday season. We have called in the experts to help alleviate a little bit of the holiday stress. Joining me in Studio A, the hosts of WIPR's Cellar Notes, journalist and food and wine enthusiast Al Spohler, and Hugh Sisson, the founder of Heavy Seas Brewery. They are celebrating their 25th anniversary of Cellar Notes, which you hear Wednesday and Friday afternoons during All Things Considered here on WIPR. It's good to see you both. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And listeners, you can join us. You can give us a call with your favorite suggestion for a good wine to pair with that special holiday meal or a good cocktail to enliven your party. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We are also streaming on Facebook today at the WIPR Facebook page. And thanks to our good friend, not only is she our videographer, but our set designer, Jemila Krimple. if you're watching on Facebook now, you'll see this incredible set that we have. We've got an entire library devoted to things having to do with wine and cocktails. We've got a whole set here. We've got bottles of wine and cocktails. I'm not quite sure where Jemila got those. I don't actually want to know, but I'm glad that the studio is decked out. So, Al, 25 years.
Yeah, I have a little surprise for you. Cast your eyes on this. I dug up literally just a couple days ago. I'm handing him a black notebook, and he's looking at the script.
This is the script for the first one?
The very first show we ever did.
It says December 17th, 1992.
Yep.
25 years ago, 2 days ago.
So, Hugh, this is what you said back then. You said, hello and welcome to Cellar Notes, Baltimore Public Radio's weekly look at the fine wine and great beer. I'm Hugh Sisson, and then Al comes in. I'm Al Spohler. I'm reading the script here. Today, we're going to be looking at some of the most delicious and unusual beers that you'll come across all year long. Christmas beers.
Right? Yeah.
And then there's a lot of blank space on the page there.
We had to dig deep for that. But the funny thing is, we just finished doing another Christmas beer show. So
you can never do too many of those.
No,
this is obviously back at in the WJHU days.
That's
before
right. Yeah.
WIPR became the owners of the license. I mean, your aspiration with this show, Hugh, is to not make experts out of people, but you're really just sharing what you know.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is, I've been doing this professionally for 30-some years. Al has been doing this relatively professionally for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is, there's so much to know, it can be overwhelming. So let's just find some things that we personally enjoyed and share that enthusiasm. It's not about snobbery. It's not about trying to become an expert. It's not about allowing yourself to be intimidated. It's more about just, here, try this. Did you like it? That's all you need to know.
Yeah. And trends seem to happen when it comes to wine. We're going to talk about cocktails later in the show. We're not going to talk about that now. But you know, I remember in the 80s, all of a sudden, you didn't offer somebody a wine. You offered them Chardonnay.
Oh, yeah.
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
So how does that happen?
Oh, I'm not sure how it happens, but thank goodness that it does. One of the things I figured out pretty quickly, Tom, is that this is a really great subject to stay with over the long haul because something new is always happening. At the very least, every vintage is a new event. But we have entirely new wine regions coming online. I mean, back when we started, nobody knew about New Zealand.
No, you know, really.
Nobody really cared a whole lot about Spanish wines or Portuguese wines. So it's been self-renewing. How trends happen? It's largely marketing.
Sure.
Somebody comes up with a good idea. In California, the thing that happened was that Chardonnay became popular at the same time as fitness became popular, and people were changing their diet and their drinking habits. And for some reason, they thought that white wine was a better choice than red wine. I can't explain that. But
from a fitness perspective.
You go out jogging, and you come back, and you drink some Chardonnay.
Right, and that's better for you than if you come back and have a glass of red wine. But the other thing that I think that plays into it is price point. Because, for example, when we first started doing this, Australian wines really were not on the radar.
Not much.
And so when they began to become available, they were perceived as being great values vis-a-vis Napa and Sonoma. So that sort of lent a little steam to that. And then that's what's happened over and over again. That's where the Spanish wines have come from. The Portuguese wines are now, I think, beginning to pick up a little momentum. Alsatian wines, kind of up and down, but yeah.
Yeah, and of course, we'll talk a little bit about different wines at different price points that you guys can recommend. But here in Maryland, there is a Maryland wine industry that didn't exist when you started doing this program, I would imagine. I mean, it didn't seem to. I mean, I've lived here 35 years, so going on 36. So it seems to me that I never heard about Maryland wines in the early years.
It did exist, but it was so minuscule, you could be easily excused for not having known about it. Bordeaux was around. Linganore was around. A few others.
So they have been around for
for quite a while.
Ham Mowbray started Bordeaux. Right. I want to say 50 years.
Not Bordeaux. He was.
He wasn't Bordeaux.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, then
he was Mowbray.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But it was Philip Wagner.
That's
started,
who it was. Yeah.
Started not far from where you live.
Yeah, right across the street.
And but the thing that's happened now, Tom, for so many years we only had about 9 or 10 wineries, and then about 12, 15 years ago, this corn started to pop. Today, we have over 90, which is just unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah, that's news to me. I didn't realize it was that that complete. As a matter of fact, we have a caller, John from Glenarm, wants to talk a little bit about some of his favorite Maryland wines. John, welcome to Midday with Hugh Sisson and Al Spohler.
Thank you, Tom, for having me in. And Hugh and Al, we all know each other loosely. And Al, I got to participate with you in the Governor's Cup this year. And I just wanted to throw out, I'm actually going to do our holiday dinner with all Maryland wines. And just a couple I'm going to use Old Westminster's Tapestry and Big Cork's Cabernet Franc with a peppercorn cracked filet.
That sounds great.
And then I'm going to use that great Chol Vidal Blanc that we all enjoyed at the tasting.
What time am I supposed to arrive?
You're more than...
What time's dinner, John? Yeah.
Right.
Well, those sounds like great suggestions, John. Thanks for the call. I mean, when it comes to pairing a wine with a kind of dinner, if you know you're going to have turkey for dinner, if you're going to have a goose, if you're going to have spicy food, I mean, can you give me, as a complete neophyte, you know, I mean, I need to admit to everybody that in our house, I do the cooking, and my wife, Linnell, is our sommelier. So she orders the wines in restaurants. She buys the wines at the wine store. I don't have anything to do with it. I just enjoy the fruits, as it were, of her labor. But give me some of the basics about how you pair a wine. You know, why red wine with meat and white wine with fish and all that?
That's not a hard and fast rule by any means. But here's a good place to start is the weight of the food, whether it's a big hearty food or a medium body food or something light. You want to have a wine of the same weight. So a big hearty beef stew would, well, you want to have a big hearty wine. And then if you have a little delicate crab salad, for instance, you might want to have something very, very light and delicate. So you match body to body. Then you start getting into some of the esoteric things, and they're really not too hard to figure out. Tannin, which is present in a lot of big red wines, works really well cutting through the fats in proteins.
So which is why you typically pair it with roast beef and things along those lines. Yeah.
So, so when I think a heavy wine and a light wine, mm-hmm. as the amateur that I am, I think red is heavier than white in general. Is that wrong? But there are such things as light red wines and heavy white wines.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's full-bodied whites, definitely. I mean, mm-hmm. a really big oaky Chardonnay certainly qualifies as a big full-bodied white wine.
And like when you use the adjective oaky, mm-hmm. right? Because people talk about the bouquet and the mm-hmm. oakiness, the fullness and stuff. These are adjectives that are somewhat universally accepted, right? In other words, people who study wine, people who really know wine, the sommeliers at the restaurant, when they use the term oaky, they're using it in exactly the same way that you guys would use it?
I would say more or less. I mean, there is certainly an accepted vocabulary. Which is used by most people, the wine speak people, although, and some of it is, just sort of trying to come up with a comparative flavor, and some of it's actually technical. I mean, when you're talking about oakiness, I mean, the wines are aged in oak barrels, and they will have a characteristic of the wood. So that's a specific reference to production technique.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you would never refer to a wine as oaky if it weren't put in an oak barrel.
Well, yeah. It's more a question of you probably wouldn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. And one of the things that we've talked about for years is, you know, and you mentioned earlier about things coming in and out of fashion is, you know, the amount of oak that's in the wine has kind of gone from people who wanted them really woody and people who don't want any wood at all. And I think more or less now the people are sort of figuring out that maybe a nice amount, a nuance is good, a bludgeon is not so hot.
Mm-hmm. So, Al, you're a journalist. You've written about wine. You've obviously done this show with Hugh for all these years. Do you seek out or do you have certain sources that you yourself go to, experts about whom, whose opinion you trust?
I did initially. Mm-hmm. I was a huge devotee of Robert Parker.
Mm-hmm. And he's a Marylander, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep. He lives right up there around Moncton.
Mm-hmm.
And a very, very nice fellow, I have to say. And I don't get to see him very often, but he's just a pleasure to hang out with and talk wine. But initially, when I didn't know anything, I was getting the Wine Advocate, and I'd be reading his reviews of the wines and couldn't figure out quite the vocabulary, you know, because he would use a lot of terms to describe a wine, some of which sounded very fanciful, and I was having trouble picking it up. But after years and years of sitting down and taking notes every time I had a new bottle of wine, I started to develop my own vocabulary. And then eventually I came to a place where I felt, well, I don't need him to tell me what to get. You know, I'm well schooled enough to go out and find what I want and what intrigues me. So, no, I don't have a whole lot of big influences anymore. I just go out and look for things. Now, you talk to people in the trade, of course, and I have friends in the trade who I always listen to, and we try to stay current that way, and they can bring things to our attention that are a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Like Portugal, for instance. You know, I had not thought a whole lot about Portugal until somebody in the wine trade said, you know, we've got a lot of really nice things coming out of Portugal. I said, really? And yeah, it turned out they did.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been espousing for years is to develop a good relationship with your local wine merchant. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time, but we don't taste, or at least I don't taste, anywhere near as many wines as the guy who's running the corner store. So if you develop a relationship with somebody and they get to know your palate and you get to know their palate, you know, after a while, you can walk in and they'll be the first ones to say, oh, here's six new things you want to try.
Sure.
And that's, I think that's probably the single most valuable thing you can do, because mm-hmm. they'll understand your comfort price point and what your flavor profiles are, and they can steer you really well into some good experiences.
And palates do change from
Absolutely.
Person to person.
There's right. no doubt about it. I mean, and my palate maybe, has changed a lot.
And yet your palate has evolved.
Absolutely.
Just yeah. And I suppose on one level, the definition of a good wine is a wine that tastes good to you.
Bingo.
Exactly.
That's the only
that's
thing
it.
You need to know.
That's
yeah.
it. That's
yeah,
I'm
so whether or not one palate, you know, one person with a particular palate profile would like it, or maybe another person doesn't, it doesn't make it a bad wine. It
no.
just means it's a good wine for person A and a bad wine for person B.
And I'm pretty sure I speak for Al here. I mean, I'm completely done with the wine snobs and the beer snobs. I mean, truthfully, what we're all really looking for is a great $10 bottle of wine. And anybody who really enjoys wine, that's what you're looking for. Yeah.
And
anybody
it's doable. Can, a $10 bottle of wine is doable.
It's doable. Absolutely. It's a little more challenging than it used to be. Mm-hmm. But yeah. But it's really all about ultimately what you like. Done. That's yeah. all you need to know. Yeah.
Well, we will talk about some of those doable $10 bottles of wine when we come back from a quick break. Al Spohler and Hugh Sisson, they are celebrating their 25th year as hosts of Cellar Notes, which you can hear here on WIPR every Wednesday and Friday afternoon. They're here in Studio A with us. We're talking wines for the holidays. 410-662-8780 is the number if you want to be part of our conversation. Our email midday@wipr.org to find us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. You can also stream us live on the WIPR Facebook page. Stick around, we will be right back. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby joins me for the hour. We'll talk about her efforts to curb the rising tide of violence in Baltimore. State's Attorney Mosby will take your questions and mine tomorrow right here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we are discussing wines for every budget with WIPR's resident sommeliers, Hugh Sisson and Al Spohler. They're laughing when I describe them as that. They are the hosts of Cellar Notes here on WIPR. A little later in the show, we're going to talk about some unusual cocktail concoctions with Chino Chin. He's the general manager of Pinch. It's a terrific bar in the Mount Vernon Marketplace. You are welcome to be part of our conversation now about wine. We are on Facebook, the WIPR Facebook page, streaming live. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. A couple of folks letting us know, sending us some love here on Facebook. Janet says, I buy my wines using your list, you two guys, and I've never been disappointed.
Yay.
There you go. You got a fan. And Vicky says, hi, this is a great show, and we love the live stream, and we are again indebted to our good buddy Jamila Kremple for setting up a beautiful set and filming us today. So here's a question from a listener, Michelle, who writes in on email, says, I'm throwing a party this weekend. What's an easy punch made with wine that's also festive looking that I can make? Any suggestions?
I think start with Spanish sangria as a model.
Either red or white.
Yeah, red or white. You can also just improvise with some fruit juices and sparkling wines. Prosecco in particular, I think, is really, really strong as the basis for a punch. And you got that nice sparkle that's going on. Those are some things that come immediately to mind.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So let's talk about some good deals on wine, some bottles of wine that are not, you know, expensive. So Hugh, what comes to mind first for not just this time of year, but perhaps all times of year for a good 10-15 bucks for a bottle of wine?
In the current market environment right now, South Africa presents terrific value. And we tasted a wine, the Simonsig. It's a Chenin Blanc, which tastes a little bit different from South Africa than it does from the Loire Valley. And that's like, I don't know, $10 or $11. And that's just awesome. Just a really great value. But South Africa in general right now is presenting a lot of good value.
All right. And Al, what comes to mind for you?
I got a hold of a bunch of wines from Spain last spring. And I'm tasting through them. And there's this one little wine called La Camina from the Madrid area. And I know historically Madrid has made crap wine. So my expectations are
Madrid's
really,
a city.
I know. I mean, it's got a big area around it with vineyards, and they haven't put a lot of thought
Madrid
into
County,
quality.
I guess.
Yeah. Right? Well, anyway, it turns out that, you know, this is made from Tempranillo, and whoever is making it is taking it seriously. So I pop the cork, and I'm tasting this delightful, wonderful, lightweight red wine that is just a smile. And I've been introducing it around every chance I get. And people just love that wine. And it's $10 or $9 or something like that.
So now what does a vintner need to do to make a wine that affordable? I mean, what corners are they cutting? How do you get there?
Well, they're not cutting corners. What they're doing is just the opposite. The first thing is yield, controlling yield in the vineyard. If you have, let's say, 10 tons per acre, you're probably, that's too much. And the target is 4 tons per acre or less. But if you just keep the yield down on your grapevines, you're going to be making better wine almost automatically. And then following just normal, what are the normal standard modern winemaking procedures with a big emphasis on hygiene. And if you do all those things, you're probably going to make pretty good wine. There is not that much crappy wine left in the world.
Really isn't.
You know.
One other thing that plays into this, for example, is we mentioned South African wines, and there's a number of older California producers, you know, who bought this land when they could buy it for 10% of what you'd buy it for now. So some of these older producers can afford to make really high quality juice at a pretty reasonable price point.
The fires that took place throughout Napa Valley earlier this year, is that going to affect in a really serious and deleterious way the 2017 vintage? Do you have any notion of what it's going to mean for California and the wine industry?
Yeah, it can't. It's not going to help.
It's not
good. That's
sure.
For sure. I know there were a few wineries that went down. William Hill, for instance.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
I think William Hill got hit. So for them, that's catastrophic. I think a lot of the vineyards have been burned down, but they can be replanted. So there will be a temporary hit, definitely. But I haven't seen a report on what it's likely to be.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, a beer tasting or mm-hmm. a wine tasting or a cocktail tasting, for that matter, a friend of mine went to a whiskey tasting
right.
Saturday. Does it come from the same part of the brain? I mean, you own a brewery, you know all about, you know, you founded
right.
Sissons, you know, you started Sissons, which closed 20 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, a little more.
Yeah, which was the first brew pub mm-hmm. where you were brewing it and serving it in the pub here in Baltimore. Is a knowledge of beer, a knowledge of champagne, a knowledge of wine, a knowledge of sparkling wines, is it all in the same bailiwick, or are they really different disciplines?
No, I think it all comes from kind of the same place. I mean, the whole thing is, if you find it interesting, then it's sort of fun to pursue, and then the more you come to know and understand about process and technique and what's involved, the greater avenues you have to pursue. If you just don't care, then, and that's totally fine, because there's a lot of people that's just not that important to them, well, then that's a little different thing. But it's the same. I think it comes from the same space where people who are interested in cooking or interested in food in general, it's all tied together.
410-662-8780. That's our number here at Midday. We're talking wines with Al Spohler and Hugh Sisson. Email at Midday is midday@wipr.org, or Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. And you could catch us streaming live on Facebook at the WIPR Facebook page. So, Al, all these wine shops, and there's so many nice ones here in the Baltimore area, they often offer tastings. If you're a neophyte, if you're new to understanding wine, to buying wine, to enjoying wine, what's your advice for, you know, the woman who's going to her first or second wine tasting? How should she approach that endeavor to get the most out of it?
Like she's squeezing produce in the grocery aisle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it should be very informal. They'll put a number of glasses out there for you to try, or a number of wines in little plastic cups usually, and sip. And if you find something you like and the price is right, take it home. It's just that simple. What you should do is ask your favorite wine merchant, when's the next time you're going to have an in-store tasting, and then write that down and, you know, be sure to show up. But it's a really great opportunity to try before you buy. And you don't have to be analytical about it at all. All you have to do is say, I like this one. I like this. And you don't have to explain why. That's good enough. You know, just, I like it.
And when you taste a bunch of different wines, you know, in close succession, that must be really difficult to decide.
It is. So you
to
always,
discern between the
You want to start with the lightest wines and work your way up. The other thing, just somewhat tangential to what you were just talking about, is always ask questions. If you're intimidated to ask the question, that's a mistake. The only stupid question is the one that you wanted to ask and you didn't. So always ask the questions, and it's all relative to price point. I like that. I like that for $10. I like that for $15. I like that for $20. What's relevant? Because that's really what's important.
Right. Then you got to decide how much you like it. Do I like this for $30?
Do I like this for $30?
I have a dumb question. Where was it written that red wine glasses need to be big and wide, and white wine glasses are taller and thinner? Why is that?
You want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll take that one. It's a matter of chemistry. The thing that happens when you pour wine into a glass is it starts to volatilize. In other words,
volatilize. That's a new one on me. What does that mean?
Part of the liquid evaporates and comes up into the air, particularly the alcohol. And it carries with it the aromas. So you want to have, for a red wine in particular, a lot of surface area on the top of the pour that will allow the maximum amount of volatility. And then the shape of the glass sort of funnels it toward your nose. It's not quite as critical with white wine, but you want to do probably pretty much the same thing. For some reason, those skinny little white wine glasses seem to emphasize acidity. There was a company called Riedel, which is an Austrian company, and they did a lengthy series of tests over many years about the shape of glasses and how it affected your perception of the wine. And they got it nailed down, you know, so they have, you know, a Chardonnay glass and a Pinot Noir glass and a Chianti glass.
And they actually kind of work.
It does.
We did this blind and we were shocked.
Yeah. Because, you know, your experience of a sip of wine, then it's not just in your tongue and your mouth. It is in your nose.
Oh, it's nose. It's 90% in your nose.
90% in your nose. Easily. So it's an olfactory thing.
And that's why the volatiles are so important.
So that, like, when you, the rituals about people when they are testing the wine, you know, the waiter comes to the table with the wine, opens it up, gives you the cork to sniff.
That's kind of hooey.
Okay. And then you put it in the, you put a little bit, and you swirl it around. Why do you swirl it around?
Well, you want to open up the wine, as we say. And what you're really looking for at that point is a healthy bottle of wine. Because if it's corked, that is, the cork has been contaminated and it's just gone bad, you should be able to pick it up right away. And you if it is, you point it out to the guy who served it to you, and they should replace it immediately without argument.
So you can just show the cork.
And it's not the cork. It's the flavor, and particularly the aroma in that glass.
So sniffing it is important. So you need to make sure.
And that's really what you're just looking for, is has the cork damaged the wine?
Yeah.
And it happens more than people realize.
And so many more wines now are twist off.
Yeah.
Does that matter? Yay. Right? Because it's not affecting the wine.
It eliminates the cork problem. Right.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something, Tom. I have a good cellar. And I have a lot of wines that are over 10 years of age. I would bet that one-third of the bottles that I bring up from my cellar, the cork falls apart when I try to draw it.
Right. So does that mean the bottle of wine is definitely bad news to begin with?
It could be, but it's a real problem getting all those little itty-bitty pieces of floating cork out of your wine.
Right.
So yeah,
but it doesn't. So a busted-up cork when you open it doesn't necessarily indicate that the wine is bad.
No, probably not.
But the cork is certainly dry.
Yeah.
We have a caller from Catonsville, Donnell. Welcome to Midday with Al Spohler and Hugh Sisson.
Hi, thank you so much. I don't know one thing about wine. I grew up with one dusty bottle of Manischewitz on the top of my grandmother's cabinet, and we'd have a tablespoon of it in ginger ale on New Year's Eve, and she'd start fanning herself with her hand.
Oh, you know how to party, Donnell. You know how to party.
It was hilarious, and this happened all the way through my teens. But I'm an artist, and I have been having a wonderful time helping local vineyards. I'm all about promoting local businesses, but particularly local farmers. And I have been having a great time helping vineyards introduce new wines to novices like me in particular by holding sip and paints. And if you're not familiar with
I've heard of these, right, sip and paint.
So you go to 90 minutes of just a blast, and I'm learning about different types of wine glasses, and sometimes we paint grapes, and we do Maryland flora and fauna, and whatever you can think of. But it really tends to bring people in, and my company is Agape Interiors, and we have done fundraisers, bachelor parties with beer steins, baby showers, birthdays, you name it. But it
and you
really
don't know how to you don't have to know how to paint when
sipping.
You don't have to know how to paint when you go to these things. You'll teach folks how to paint, and then you'll also teach them a little bit about wine. Yeah, that sounds like fun. I mean, there are thanks for the call, Danelle. I appreciate it. There are lots of ways that the vineyards and the wine industry is reaching out to people, millennials and younger people now. It seems, if I had to guess, and I haven't done any research about this, but if I had to guess, that cocktails are making more of a resurgence with young people and not so much wine. Is that right?
Yeah, I think cocktails are very popular, there's no question about it. But a lot of the people who are concerned with farm-to-table eating are also concerned with vineyard-to-bottle drinking. And a lot there's growing support for the local wineries solely because they're local. And that's wonderful. There are so many things that they are doing to promote Maryland wines now. We have wine trails. Most of the wineries have really nice tasting rooms. It's a great way to spend a weekend afternoon just going out and visiting a couple of these places. It's eye-opening. It really is.
Yeah, places like Bourdie Vineyards, I know, has music.
Yep.
You can go to for parties, you know, yep. And there are several others here in town.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a question coming in on email. Martin wants to know again the name of the winery near Madrid with the great red wine.
Oh, La Camina.
La Camina.
Yeah,
La
think
Camina.
Of Camino, which means the road, but Camina, La Camina.
La Camina,
yeah,
near
pretty,
Madrid.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to find.
All right. Let's up the ante a little bit, Hugh. Uh-oh. So instead of a $10 bottle of wine, $15 bottle, let's get up to $30. What if we're going to splurge a little bit? What would you say, particularly for holiday meals? You know, you're cooking a turkey or doing some big deal for Christmas Day or New Year's Eve or something like that.
Well, if you're in the $30 range, I mean, you should be easily able to find a pretty good bottle of wine. I mean, that's going to open you up to some pretty good level Napa Cabernets. Zinfandel is a region that Al and I just came back from, is Alsace. And you should be able to buy some Grand Cru level Rieslings and or Pinot Gris from a number of Alsatian producers in that price point, certainly, easily.
What, by the way, is the difference between Pinot Gris, G-R-I-S, and Pinot Grigio?
Same grape, different sort of vinification approach. I mean, the Italians are going to take it in a different direction than the Alsatians. The Pinot Gris in Alsace is a wine with flavor. Pinot Grigio in much of, not all of, but much of Italy is sort of low-level, bland, not much there.
Mm-hmm. And Al, how about you? What's on your list for a $30 range?
Between, say, $25 and $30, Valpolicella Rapasso. Mm-hmm. Valpolicella is arguably one of my top five favorite wines in the world. And the Rapasso is a really cool trick. They pour the made wine over top of the skins from the Amarone that they just finished making, and it picks up that additional flavor. So it's repassed Rapasso through the Amarone skins, and you get what I call junior varsity Amarone, which means it's very, very rich, but just a lovely, lovely wine.
And so, Amarone is
Amarone is
stuff.
$50 to $75 bottle.
Right.
Yeah. I would also point out Maryland Cabernet Franc from a place like Big Cork, for instance, or Old Westminster. These are fabulous wines. Cab Franc does extremely well in Maryland, and our Cab Francs tend to be fairly big and just loaded with flavor. So,
and Cabernet Franc is different than Cabernet Sauvignon, yeah, or uh-huh, something like different that.
As they say, a cousin. But
it's a cousin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So typically, a lot of Cabernet Franc is blended with Cabernet Sauvignon to make blended red wines, mm-hmm, in the Bordeaux.
And
area.
There are some wines that are sort of automatically sweeter, like when you guys mentioned Riesling.
Uh-huh.
I'm under the impression that Riesling is generally sweeter. Is that wrong? Do I have that right?
Depends where it comes from. In Germany, they have a whole classification system for special sweet Rieslings. but they also make a lot of very dry Riesling. In Alsace, it's almost entirely dry, although they have these things called Vendange Tardif, which is late picked, and that gets very sweet too. Mm-hmm.
Rosé has made a comeback.
Rosé is huge.
It was just that, you know, if you drank a glass of rosé, it was like drinking grape juice with extra sugar. But that's not the case anymore.
Rosé is making a huge comeback. It's actually a great wine for a lot of the holiday meals that you're going to have with your turkey and things along those lines. Look for the ones that come from the south of France, in particular. There's a bunch of nice rosés coming out of California now. You can find some rosés of Pinot Noir, which are certainly worth looking at. Rosé's good.
Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have a vineyard that makes rosé. My wife got some. We had some. It's really pretty good. The Brangelina rosé. I don't know if it's still going because they've had their problems.
I heard the problem is after you've had that on the shelf for a while, it begins to separate.
Ba-dum-bum. Hugh Sisson, ladies and gentlemen, he'll be here till Thursday. Be sure to try the veal. So, Al, you mentioned, you know, matching the sort of the weight of the wine with the weight of your entree, you know, mm-hmm. a heavier wine for a heavier entree and a lighter wine for a lighter entree. What if your entree is vegetarian or vegan? What if you're not having any meat or fish?
Well, that tends to be probably middle of the palate or lighter. And I would tend toward white wines there, and just a lot to explore. If something's a little bit on the sweet side, you might your dish, for instance, you may go toward Viognier, would be a nice, or Chenin Blanc. Mm-hmm. If it's a drier, simpler thing, I think Sauvignon Blanc is absolutely fabulous with vegetables.
All right, Sauvignon Blanc for vegetables. How about New Year's Eve, champagne or sparkling wines? Anything we want to recommend for
it depends on how boisterous the party.
Right, Al and I have been believers for years that if you're going to a big party, you bring a cheap bottle of sparkling wine. Inexpensive is probably better. The Spanish cavas are perfect for that because there's no reason to bring a $100 bottle of sparkling wine. You're not going to taste it. You're in the throes of partydom. If you want to spend some money, you've got a good suggestion there.
Oh, yeah, I mean, just the classic champagnes. If you want to really spend a lot, like $100 or so, Paul Roget's wines, it was Churchill's favorite. So it got him through World War II. It'll get you through New Year's Eve.
That's right. Well.
And champagne and sparkling wine are two different things, right?
No, they're the same thing.
They are the same thing.
Champagne comes from a very particular place
in France. Right.
And they're the only ones that are entitled to
use that term.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys coming by. Happy holidays. It's fun to not only get a little bit more erudite in the area of wine, but also to give you a shout out for 25 years of doing the show.
Thank you.
We look forward to the next episodes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
All
much.
Right. Al Spohler is the co-host of WIPR's Cellar Notes and a member of the Cork and Fork Society here in Baltimore. Hugh Sisson is the founder of Heavy Seas Brewery. He's a craft brewing expert and also a co-host of Cellar Notes. Now in its 25th season here on WIPR. Remember, you can catch Cellar Notes every Wednesday and Friday afternoon during All Things Considered right here on 88.1. After a quick break, we're going to turn from wine to spirits. Chino Chin is on the way with suggestions for cocktails that will enliven your holiday parties. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.